What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Kathy Werling, author of Mommy, Who is Irina Sendler? We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shin Shiniot, Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This is a leap year on the Jewish lunar calendar, which means that we are now in the midst of the first of 2 months, both called Adar, Adar Rishon and Adar Sheni in Hebrew, meaning first and second Adar. You see, unlike the solar calendar used in America and throughout the West, well, throughout the world really, which has one leap day every 4 years, February 29th, on the more complicated reconciliation necessary for the Jewish moon-based calendar, there's actually an entire month added every so often. To be more precise, there are 7 leap years in a 19-year cycle, with a month added in each one. And the month that's added is called First Adar, followed by a second month also called Adar, Second Adar. You got all that? If not, you are in very good company, which is why most Jewish organizations print up Jewish calendars to tell you when the next Jewish holiday is coming up. I have an app on my phone that does that. In any case, the month of Adar is traditionally seen as a very joyous time for 2 reasons. First, we see the beginning of the signs of spring in Adar after a cold winter. This one certainly fits that characterization in most places in North America. And secondly, it is the month when the ultra-happy holiday of Purim takes place. However, when we are in a leap year, like we are now, that means Purim is still a ways away. It is always in the second month of Adar when there are 2. More importantly than all of this complicated calendar calculating, we Jews say, Mishenichnas Adar marbim besimcha. When you enter Adar, you multiply joy. I hope that proves to be true for all of you two Jewish listeners. Now, this may be midwinter for people in most northern hemisphere climes, but it's definitely the beginning of spring for us in the Southwest and in Florida, where baseball spring training games are starting. That means it's now time here in Tucson, Arizona, to play our classic welcome to the coming baseball season, Mandy Patinkin's Yiddish version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Will if kein mul von dort nit a weg git se gut mut mut dit ball spieler es passt nit as men far spiel weil sie sei zwei drei steigs neus bei der baseball spiel.
That was Nemt mir ois zu dem ball game, as sung by Mandy Patinkin in the Yiddish version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game. That melody, by the way, was written by Albert von Tilzer, a Jewish Tin Pan Alley top songwriter from Indiana, music to words by Jack Norworth. When they wrote Take Me Out to the Ball Game, neither of the songwriters had ever been to a baseball game, and that remained the case for decades. But their song has certainly made it to every game for the last, 80 years or so. This is also the end of rodeo weekend here in Tucson, Arizona, in the heart of the Wild West, where I live, so we need some Western themes this morning, too. You can't really understand what a big deal rodeo week is in Tucson unless you live here, and have lived here for at least a year or two, or 20, like me. In Tucson, our rodeo week consists of a big parade, followed by, I know this will shock you, a big rodeo. We let kids out of school for a couple of days to go to the parade and wear cowboy hats and boots and generally pretend that there is still some connection to the folks who rode horses and tamed the Wild West. When you live in the heart of the West, not far from Tombstone in what was Apache country not much over a century ago, rodeo can still be a pretty big deal. Actually, this year, my own congregation, Beit Simcha, did something I don't believe has ever been done before. We held an actual Shabbat afternoon service on horseback that I led in the midst of a trail ride. It was awesome. Now, you might not immediately associate Jews and cowboys, but there were quite a number of Jews in the Old West. The legendary O.K. Corral gunslinger and lawman Wyatt Earp's wife, his common-law wife, well, his last one anyway, was a Jewish woman named Josephine Marcus. There were Jewish mayors, sheriffs, and outlaws. And there are photos of them wearing the appropriate linen dusters, cowboy boots, and gun belts that have survived over a century, too. Some of these Jews were involved in notorious incidents, and if you aren't sure of that, go visit Boot Hills Jewish Cemetery in Tombstone, Arizona itself, where not a few of them are buried. And of course, there were many Jewish merchants, including some of my own ancestors, the Reinhardts, who had a couple of stores in the gold rush in the rich foothills of the gold country near Auburn, California. I'm sure they probably sold dungarees there, especially the newly invented ones with rivets by a German Jewish entrepreneur named Levi Strauss. Some of us still wear that brand. And so, to honor all of those Jewish cowboys, merchants, and characters, here's a less than perfectly accurate musical version of another one of those legendary Jewish characters of the Old West. Long before saddles blazed across, there was the Ballad of Irving.
He was short and fat and rode out of the West with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big short Irving. Big short fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread with a 10-gallon yarmulke on his head. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sissy Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. 141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143, walking the Sol Saloon like a man insane, and ordered three fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Irving. The James boys was coming on a train at first sun, and the town said, Irving, we need your gun. Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big help Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Finally, Irving got three slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down. Irving. Big fat Irving. Big dum-dum Irving. Big dum-dum dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Really?
That was the Ballad of Irving, redefining the word classic all by itself. Sort of about being Jewish in the Wild West. Our guest this morning has written a children's book about the Holocaust that isn't just for children. It includes an incredible story of great heroism during the Shoah, inspirational and powerful, and definitely not well known. Find out what it is when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Kathy Werling is the author of the new book, children's book, Mommy, Who Was Irina Sendler? She wrote it, illustrated by Maggie Recuse. It's from the Lowell Milken Center. It's a part of a series called Children's Unsung Heroes book series. A really interesting series, but a particularly moving book. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Well, thank you.
All right. So how did you get into this?
Well, I tell you what, I am a retired elementary school teacher here in Fort Scott, Kansas. And a few years ago, I knew about the Milken Center. I'd been to visit it. It was when we had a smaller facility across the street, and it's all about unsung heroes and about helping people realize that everything we say and everything we do each day can make a powerful impact on people, and we may not even know it. And so I toured that just one day, and I particularly was touched by the story of Irina Sendler, which is the founding project for our center. And so after I retired, I just thought, I need a purpose. I retired a little early, and I wasn't quite ready to get away from what I'd been doing. And I just called and said, you know, if you guys ever need anybody to volunteer to work down here, just let me know. And so one day I got a call. They needed someone to come down, and this partnership just kind of developed. I work a couple days a week. We now have the brand-new facility, a state-of-the-art museum across the street. And it's gorgeous, and it has amazing stories. And I simply, you know, work, help giving tours and all. But then it kind of developed into, what else can we do? And I said, well, you know, we focus on kids in elementary, upper elementary school, and middle school and high school. And I said, but I taught younger children, and I just feel like we need to start there with helping them understand that the way they treat others and what they do and say every day is so important to what our world will become. And so anyway, they said, well, we want a children's book series. Would you ever consider that? And I said, I'd love to. I love writing. I love sharing with kids. And so started there, and that's how I am here today.
It's an extraordinary story. Just really briefly, this is about a non-Jewish woman, a Polish Catholic social worker, who saved the lives of many Jewish children in Poland during the war. You know, it's also kind of a tragic story, of course, but a really powerful one. Did you identify with her?
Well, I didn't. I did in the sense that I thought, you know, it's so easy some days to look at something hard to do and then to think, oh, I can't do that, or I'll do something about it tomorrow. And she took action. She couldn't stand to see the suffering around her. So in that sense, I did. I do wonder, you know, what would I have done if I had been in her situation? Could I have been as brave as she? And that's something to wrestle with and to think about, because we never know what we're going to be faced with in life.
Well, that is certainly true. We will talk more about the specific story of Irina Sendler with our guest this morning, Kathy Werling, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills, is celebrating its first services, classes, and events this winter and spring. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is dedicated to creating a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills in northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills. Our magnificent new Beit Simcha home at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell, across from La Encantada, holds services, classes, and events. Everyone is welcome. Join us this Friday night at Skyline in Campbell. Shabbat services begin at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Torah study is at 9, and services are at 10. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, our rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, go to www.BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Or BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You've come back. I know this is redundant from a very long trip recently. One of the topics that's been in the news a great deal has been a reexamination of roles during the Holocaust, you know, more than 75 years ago now for many. It's not so obvious who the villains and the heroes were sometimes. It's not so obvious which countries were anti-Semitic because or were collaborated with the Nazis. It's not so obvious what really happened even sometimes, but in particular, it's not black and white. And memory is complicated.
It certainly is, and it's also subjective. And we often tend to generalize as human beings from one limited experience and say, well, we met this one anti-Semitic person in Hungary or Poland, whatever, so they're all that way. You know, I think once before we spoke on this show about an experience I had in a little town in southeastern Poland called Nowy Sącz, where while traveling with a group of high school kids who were ultimately on their way to Israel, and after we visited the Warsaw Ghetto and Auschwitz and whatever, we were on a train to Budapest. But that train crossed the border into the former Czechoslovakia at a border crossing point that was only open to citizens of those two countries, fraternal socialist countries, whatever. So basically, in the middle of the night, literally at midnight, we were forced to get off the train and fend for ourselves. So I sent two other adults down the main street to see if they could find a hotel and thought, we'll deal with it from there. I mean, we had these tickets, we had paid the National Travel Agency, which was run by the government. In those days, in all the communist countries, there was a national agency that was part of the government that controlled all foreign travel, hotels, trains, whatever. They should have known better. So by a stroke of miraculous luck, these guys found kind of a high-rise, fairly modern hotel in this small town, and they roused the hotel director, who was one of these big, authoritative communist women. She was an official also of Orbis. She said, those people in Warsaw did this again? I can't believe it. And she started cursing in Polish. Anyway, she very hospitably gave us rooms. She said, Warsaw will pay. Don't worry. I'll charter a bus tomorrow. I'll send you and the children on to Budapest. Blah, blah, blah. Well, slowly it came out when she saw the boys putting on tefillin in the morning and the group davening the morning prayers, she cried. And she said, the last time I saw Jewish children praying was before the war. My family hid a Jewish family in our basement. And she went on and on to talk about her memories of Jews in this small town before the war. She showed us the cemetery. I mean, she was anything but the stereotypical Polish anti-Semite who didn't have time for Jews. She had all the time in the world. And then she gave us something that was worth its weight in gold in those days in Poland, which was she gave each kid a bottle of Coca-Cola for the journey. So that was like a month's salary. I mean, honestly, she could not have been nicer. And, you know, because of that one experience, And also because of my knowledge of history, I would never believe that all Poles were anti-Semitic or they were all complicit in the Holocaust or whatever. But the situation is very complicated and the question of memory is very complicated. So we have more to talk about next week.
We will remember and talk about it next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A gorgeous woman gets on a bus, clearly distraught, and sits down next to a guy. She is visibly upset. Finally, can contain herself no longer, she turns to the man and says, "I just saw my therapist. He says I have a big problem." "What's the problem?" the guy asks. She says, I can't tell you. I don't even know you." The guy says, "Well, sometimes it's good to tell your problems to a perfect stranger on a bus." So the girl says, "Well, my therapist just told me that I'm a nymphomaniac, but I only like Jewish cowboys." That does feel good to say that. "By the way, now that you know all about me, my name is Susan." And the guy says, "Hello, Susan. My name is Bucky Goldstein." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniyot, our representatives of the Weintraub Israel Center, young representatives of Israel in America, Ron Benakot and Rotem Rappaport, who just came back from Israel a little while ago. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So tell us a little bit about Sofim, about scouts, Israeli scouts, and how that works and what your experience just was on this trip.
So the Israeli scouts are also in Israel, but there is a lot of different shvatim in
Tribes
America.
In,
yeah,
in
exactly.
Hebrew, right?
In America. And we got the opportunity to go to California to be a part, to be counselors at Sofim camp. And I think it was a great experience just because we got to see all different kind of people and to get to know them. And
so these are Sofim, they're shvatim, they're what we would think of as packs, but it tribes of Israeli scouts,
right,
that are located in the United States?
Yes, because those are Israeli kids or kids that were born to Israeli parents.
Uh-huh.
And
who were living in the United States at the time.
Exactly. And okay. The Sofim just wants to connect them to Israel. So it's really cool. They try to speak Hebrew as much as they can. And we obviously try to speak Hebrew as much as we can.
I think you're pretty good at it, actually.
It was kind of hard with them because at the minute someone starts talking to you in English, you kind of like...
You shift
yeah,
gears because you guys have now been here for 6 months or something,
right,
like that. So your English
so
kicks in.
It was
in.
Weird. We started, at least me, I started talking half Hebrew, half English. Everything was kind of like...
I do that sometimes too. What were the highlights? What were the good parts for you?
So I think because... I've never taken part of the Sofim before, not in Israel, not in here. I was in a different youth movement. Mm-hmm. I think just seeing how another youth movement, how they like do camps and how is their hadracha, I don't know how to...
Well, just their system for doing things,
yeah,
right?
Just how it's different and how it's similar to what I know, to open to new worlds, to new like point of views of other like youth movements, and just seeing kids that speak Hebrew and know, like, I don't know, Israeli songs, and just feeling like Israel again and the United States made it really, really special for me.
That's great. Do you think that these scout movements, these Sofim here in the United States, do they try to convince, you know, young Israeli kids to go back to Israel, or is it just kind of to give them a sense of the culture that they're missing while they're here?
So I think it's what you said, it's to bring them the culture of Israel and the language, and just to make sure that even though they're not in Israel, to still have a part in them that is about Israel. If it's the language, it's the culture, celebrating the holidays, eating Israeli food, really the simplest things that mm-hmm. there is.
Yeah.
They just, and I think the main thing there is just to have fun and to hang out with people that are your age and in the same situation. So it's pretty cool.
Sounds great. Sounds fun. Can I go next time?
Yeah, come on.
I think I might be a little old for one of these.
No,
you're
never too
unless old. There's like a group of Zakanim that we can arrange for. Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. Hope is a tangible, unstated presence in our portion this week, Vayakhel, the penultimate sedra in the book of Exodus. On the surface, it is nothing more than a listing of how the tabernacle in the wilderness was constructed by our ancestors. Lists of materials used, processes employed, structures and implements assembled. So many pieces of wood or gold or skins of animals used to make this. These artisans employed on this or that project. Moses asked for these materials and they were graciously donated, and so on and so forth. But in another sense, this is an incredibly hopeful Torah portion, a section that truly represents the triumph of hope over experience. For in last week's Torah portion of Ki Tisa, the people of Israel dramatically failed both God and Moses. They made a golden calf, worshipped it, bowed before it, and insisted that it was their God. Just 40 days after receiving the Ten Commandments at Sinai, they forgot the revelation, abandoned monotheism, morality, and everything they had been taught. It was a devastating moment for Moses. It must have been a fundamentally depressing time for God, too. And yet, just a few passages later, we find God instructing Moses to build a tabernacle, a permanent home for the Shekhinah, the divine presence, right in the midst of this same rotten people. Those people, the Israelites, our ancestors, have just proven they are not worthy, and yet God immediately gives them a place. No, insists that they create a place that will be a constant, permanent reminder that God is always with them and will never abandon them. It almost seems like a reward for treachery. Actually, it's a promise of hope. For if God will dwell among them, Asuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham, we are told in an earlier Torah portion of Truma, build me a sanctuary, I will dwell among you. Well, that's a pledge that things can always be made good, that losses can be, in some sense, replaced, that we are always able to come into grace and blessing. I think about that juxtapositioning between the betrayal of the golden calf and the blessing of the brand spanking new tabernacle, model for this and every temple in Jewish history. It is a promise and a pledge of hope. You probably already know the Hebrew word for hope, tikvah, from the national anthem of Israel, HaTikvah. But for me, tikvah is a kind of promise from God that even after our worst moments, even in our depths of failure or despair, we can return to God, to holiness, to goodness. God will be present for us and, in fact, will be among us. So may it always be. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Kathy Werling, will tell us just how an important Holocaust center came to be located in the middle of Kansas and why the story of Irina Sendler is such a compelling one for those of us who love tales of great courage in the face of brutality and hate. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Poland's prime minister canceled plans for his country to send a delegation to meet in Jerusalem last week after the acting Israeli foreign minister said that the Poles collaborated with the Nazis and sucked anti-Semitism with their mother's milk. The acting foreign minister did this on his first day in office. The Polish pullout triggered the collapse of the planned summit of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu with leaders of four Central European nations known as the Visegrad Group. Prime Minister Netanyahu had touted the meeting as an important step in his outreach to the countries of Central Europe, which have pro-Israeli governments that he is counting on to counteract the criticism Israel typically faces in international forums, particularly in Europe. The developments mark a new low in a conflict between Poland and Israel over how to remember and characterize Polish actions towards Jews during the Nazi occupation of Poland during World War II. Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki had already announced that he was pulling out of the meeting after a comment by Netanyahu last week about Polish cooperation with the Nazis. Morawiecki canceled all Polish participation altogether after comments made by Israel's acting foreign minister Israel Katz, which the Polish Prime Minister denounced as racist and absolutely unacceptable. The summit was then downgraded to bilateral meetings between Israeli representatives and those of the already arrived Hungarian, Czech Republic, and Slovakian ministries. Poland's foreign ministry summoned the Israeli ambassador, Anna Azari, to demand a second set of clarifications in the past week. Last week's developments marked a deterioration of the disagreement that began when Netanyahu said Poles cooperated with the Nazis. Netanyahu's office then said he was misquoted. The Polish government was not satisfied with that explanation. Israel's acting foreign minister, Israel Katz, made his remarks last week in an interview on Reshet 13 TV right after getting the job. Well, temporarily getting the job anyway. "I am the son of Holocaust survivors," Katz said. "The memory of the Holocaust is not something to compromise about. It is obvious. We will not forget and we will not forgive." He then vowed that no one would change the historical truth of what happened. "Poles collaborated with the Nazis, definitely. Collaborated with the Nazis," he repeated. As Yitzhak Shamir, former Prime Minister of Israel, said, his father was murdered by Poles. He said that from his point of view, they sucked anti-Semitism with their mother's milk. You can't sugarcoat this history. Poland was the first occupation of Adolf Hitler's regime and never had a collaborationist government. Members of Poland's resistance and government in exile struggled to warn the world about the mass killing of Jews, and thousands of Poles risked their lives to help Jews. However, Holocaust researchers have collected ample evidence of Polish villagers who murdered Jews fleeing the Nazis, or Polish blackmailers who preyed on Jews and hidden Jews for financial gain. And anti-Semitism in Poland was certainly widespread and virulent long before the Nazi invasion. U.S. Ambassador to Poland, Georgette Mosbacher, called on Katz to apologize for his remarks, highlighting the fact that Poland and Israel are allies, and of course both Poland and Israel are allies of America. In other news, in France, almost 100 gravestones at a Jewish cemetery were vandalized with swastikas hours before the start of marches against the recent rise in anti-Semitic attacks in the country. French President Emmanuel Macron visited the cemetery in the eastern French village of Quatzenheim near the border with Germany and promised his government would take action. Local Jewish community representatives joined Macron as he stood in front of the graves vandalized with blue spray-painted swastikas, and together they observed several moments of silence. The French president held a moment of silence with other French leaders later that day at the Holocaust Memorial in Paris. French police reported last week, as we did here on Too Jewish, that anti-Semitic acts in France rose by 74% in 2018 over the previous year, and a wave of anti-Semitic incidents centered on Paris swept the country in recent weeks. That spurred 14 political parties, including Macron's La République en Marche and the CRIF Jewish Umbrella Group, to organize a large protest rally in response under the banner No to Anti-Semitism. That need to work against anti-Semitism has apparently not successfully crossed the channel into England, where Ruth George, a member of the House of Commons, the British Parliament's lower house, said that it was possible that the seven lawmakers who left the Labour Party last week were being supported by the State of Israel. She later issued a statement saying she was deeply sorry for her ill-thought-out and poorly worded comment. The seven MPs, including Luciana Berger, a well-known Jewish lawmaker, formed a party named the Independent Group. Joan Ryan, the former head of Labour Friends of Israel, wrote on Twitter that her former party was infected with anti-Jewish racism ever since Jeremy Corbyn became its leader in 2015. An eighth British lawmaker, an MP, jumped ship from Labour later in the week.
Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. He sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me.
There was some good news last week from down under. Australia's Prime Minister and opposition leader reinforced the bond between Israel and Australia in back-to-back addresses to Parliament, marking 70 years of friendship with Israel. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said that Israel is a beacon of democracy in the Middle East. He said that though Australia chaired the 1947 UN committee that voted to divide the territory of Mandate Palestine, Australia will be standing by Israel in the face of biased and unfair targeting of Israel in the UN General Assembly. Morrison described Israel as a nation of immigrants with a free press, parliamentary democracy, financially prosperous, the source of innovation in the world, and a refuge from persecution and genocide that is somehow now the center of cruelty in the world, according to some in the UN, and that is intellectual fraud. The leader of the Labour opposition in Australia, Bill Shorten, said, "The hard truth is that 70 years after Israel's recognition, peace and security still elude the region. All of us support the right of the people of Israel to live safely within secure borders. And as a true friend of Israel, my party strongly supports a two-state solution," he added. Israel's ambassador to Australia, Mark Sofer, responded that he appreciated the sentiments of both Australian leaders. And in sad news, one of the giants of the Jewish social justice movement, Al Vorspan, died this past week at the age of 95. Vorspan was integral to the founding and organizing of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism in Washington, D.C. For many years, he was the senior vice president of the Union of American Hebrew Congregations and served as the longtime director of the Commission on Social Action. He was an upbeat, talented, and most energetic advocate and successful activist for justice in America and the world. Al Vorspan will be deeply missed. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Kathy Werling is the author of the new children's book, Mommy, Who is Irina Sendler, a very moving publication from the Lowell Milken Center and their Unsung Heroes book series. This one, of course, focused on the Shoah, on the Holocaust. Can you tell us the story of Irina Sendler and what she did and how she did it? I mean, you've told the story in the book, but I don't think it's giving too much away to an adult audience to tell it here.
Sure. Well, Irina actually was in Poland. She was raised by very loving parents. Her dad was a physician, and he actually felt the need to help all people in need. And there was a Jewish community suffering from typhus that no one would set foot in to help, and he said, "I cannot bear to see that suffering happen." And so he went in to treat them and give them whatever comfort and care that he could. As a result, he contracted typhus, and when she was 7, he passed away. But he left her with the mantra, "Irina, if you see someone drowning, you must jump in to save them, whether you can swim or not." And she took that to heart, and that really became her moving force in life. So she became a social worker in Poland, wanting to help anyone that she could in any circumstances. And then the war hit, of course, and there was a 1.3 square mile ghetto established into which over 450,000 Jewish people were incarcerated, and it was a horrible, horrible situation. Irina could not bear to see the suffering, and so she knew that she had in some way to do something. So and she always quick to say there were other people that helped her, but with a network of 25 helpers within the welfare department, she devised plans that they could get into the ghetto. She disguised herself as a nurse and went in with whatever, quote, supplies that she could, because, of course, the Nazis would not want any close connection with anyone that had typhus. And so she kind of went under the guise, "I'm going to go in there and I'm going to take care of this problem, you know, whatever I can do." And so as she went in, she saw all these suffering children and then knew what was happening when the trains were coming for Treblinka, the concentration death camp. And so she began targeting orphan children. She would work with finding ways to get them out, and as a social welfare worker, they had access to all records, so they could do a lot of falsifying of documents, and consequently, she could give these children Polish names, teach them Polish prayers, dress them as Polish children, and get them out. There were, of course, right past the guards was one way they had to go. Sometimes, though, they would go under the walls of the ghetto through tunnels where people would be meeting them. And there were a lot of people in the Catholic Church especially who offered homes, monasteries, orphanages for safe places for these children. And then as the days are quickly moving and things are escalating, she started approaching families who were clutching their young children, their toddlers and their babies, and saying, I know you want the best for your children. If I can get them to safety, will you allow me to do that? And so, of course, heartbroken and heart-wrenching scenes developed, but she was able to, with her network, smuggle many, many children. They would give them something to sedate them and then put them in some of these bags or containers or whatever they had managed to take in with, quote, supplies, and they would get them to safe places. And, I mean, every single plan was a different plan. And then she did not ever want those children to forget or not to know about the loving parents and families they had. And so she wrote every name down, Jewish name, Polish, new Polish name she'd given them, and the home to where they'd been taken. And then she put these on little slips of paper and buried, put them in the milk jars when the jars were full. She and a coworker at the coworker's house buried them under an apple tree with the plan to dig those up after the war and start searching for all of those children to let them know how much their families love them and hopefully to reunite them with family members if that was possible. And so that's what happened. Unfortunately, she was also being targeted and watched by the Gestapo, and she was arrested and brutally beaten and put on the execution list. And it just so happened the night before she was to be executed, Jagoda, the larger network that she was involved with, also was able to bribe a German guard, and he checked off that she had been executed. And then she went into hiding for the rest of the war. And indeed, after the war, she did meet with her coworker, and they did dig up the jars, and they began looking for the children. And we have lists here at the center of hundreds of the children that she found. We don't know, you know, how many there really were, because it was a very chaotic scene at that time. And then, basically, no one heard about Irina because communism took over Poland afterwards, and of course they were not going to allow any story to be told about someone who was willing to stand up against the government. So consequently, that she was living very quiet, lonely, and really poor life. She was in poverty. And the story of how her story became told to the world is another story, because that is what our center is all about. A group of students at Uniontown High School, just down the road from where we live in Fort Scott, had an amazing history teacher, Norm Kennard, and they always did history projects about unsung heroes. And these girls happened to find in a box of clippings he had this story about Irina. And as they started investigating, they only found one little bit of information on the internet, but they were able to confirm it was true. They also contacted, you know, other organizations, Jewish organizations, Polish organizations, and they found that, indeed, the story had merit. It was true. So that they went ahead with their history project, just determined to tell this story about her, and they were looking for her grave marker. They had feelers out for that, and they get word back that she's not dead. She's still living in Poland in her 90s. And they wrote her a letter, and amazingly got a 7-page letter back, all in Polish, which they had to have translated, but she called them her dearly beloved girls and really could not believe that these girls in Kansas wanted to tell her story. Her son had recently passed away, so she was, you know, in mourning and just knew that they had been put there at the time that it was right. And so from there, these girls did their play. They called it Life in a Jar, based on what Irina had done with the names, and began performing their play at the history competition, and they won the local, they won the state, they went to nationals. But what was happening is people across the United States were hearing about this story and could not believe that this woman who had done such amazing things had never been heard about. And so she ended up there. Every news agency broadcast their story. They were asked to do interviews. A Jewish businessman paid for them to go to Poland and meet Irina. A very moving and amazing experience, and she was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. A movie by Hallmark was made about her called The Courageous Heart of Irina Sendler, and our center was established based on, you know, teaching young people today that we stand up for what is right and telling the stories of people that do. So that's kind of where we are today.
It's an extraordinary story, and her courage is remarkable. Her the children that she saved, obviously they're now elderly. How many of them have you met? Have you interacted with?
Well, personally, I have not met any of them. Well, I take that back. I guess I did. I actually saw one. I didn't really get to meet her, who had come back when our center was when the movie premiered here in Fort Scott.
Uh-huh.
But I know that these young girls that now, well, Megan was one of the girls in the play, and she is now our program director. She and her teacher were the ones that thought of the idea for this center, and they are the ones that are in charge of the center. And so they have made several trips back to Poland and got to perform their own play for Jewish survivors, and they have met several of them. We have featured at our exhibit a couple of the survivors who have actually interacted with the girls. One came back for, like I told you, at the premiere of the movie, and so she's been to Fort Scott, and she was part of helping this whole thing develop. Another one lives in Poland and became Irina's caretaker late in life. Her name's Elzbieta, and the kids got to meet her, and she actually gave them a replica of the silver spoon that her parents had put in the carpenter's box that Irina carried her out in when she was a five-month-old baby.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah.
Incredible.
I mean, it's incredible. And she was raised by a Catholic family, but after that all happened, but she never forgot her roots, and she married a poet, Jerry Fikowski, who became very much a leader in the Solidarity movement to overcome communism.
Sure,
so,
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, he's in the Solidarity Museum in Gdansk.
Okay.
I visited last summer.
Oh, wow.
Extraordinary story.
Yes, yeah. So I wish I had met some of them. I would love to have been able to do that, but I didn't. I haven't made a trip to...
So I have to ask you a question. You know, Fort Scott, Kansas is not the place we think of as the location for commemoration of the Shoah, of the Holocaust. It's a remarkable institution that exists there, and it came really because of the initiative of a teacher like yourself, a high school teacher, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Correct.
Tell us a little bit about that story and how the interaction is with the community.
Well, okay.
No offense to Fort Scott, Kansas. I apologize.
No, I totally understand. I mean, that's been asked many, many times.
I'm sure.
And Mr. Kennard is an outstanding teacher, and he's been recognized by the Milken Family Foundation. He received a Milken Educator Award back many years ago, 1992, for his outstanding work with students, and he's just nationally recognized in many different areas. But at the time, he was a teacher in Uniontown. His mother, he had come back here. His mother was ill. He was teaching in California and moved back here to help be with her and got the job there. And it's a very small school, you know. But he did so many amazing things, and these kids were winning history awards all the time. And then when this story happened and this, you know, it became so nationally recognized, and the girls themselves had to be very courageous because they had to be willing to continue this and, you know, stand up telling her story, and it kind of became their personal mission. And Megan, the one girl who now is the young woman who is our although her name's Felt now. But
Megan Stewart Felt, right.
She's
okay.
Married. She was going to be a pharmacist, and then this changed the course of her life, and she knew that this is what she wanted to do, to inspire young people and to share the stories of other unsung heroes as well as Irina's. And so she developed a very close relationship with Irina, because during the whole course of the project, Megan's mother developed cancer, and she passed away, and so Irina became a surrogate mother to Irina, as to a couple of the other girls. And a book has been written about this whole story called Life in a Jar, the Irina Sendler Project. And that's an interesting story, too, because the author of that is a Jewish pediatrician living in Middlebury, Vermont. and he'd always wanted to write a historical novel based on a true story. He had actually saved some clippings. He actually had a clipping like they had found about Irina, but it was in a rainy day file. And one day he walked into his office, and there was an article from Ladies' Home Journal about a group of students in Uniontown, Kansas, who had uncovered this story.
Incredible.
And amazing.
We say it's beshert, you know, it was just meant
exactly,
to happen.
And that's exactly, that's the word that's used all around here all the time. Many of the tours include that word, because, yes, it is, many of those things were meant to be, and so many coincidences. When Irina passed away on May 12th, 2008, it happens to be Megan's birthday. So it's just one of those things that they felt everything just fit into the way it was supposed to be. But they, when they talked about this center, establishing this, they approached the Milken Family Foundation because, you know, financially we were trying to figure out how to, they were trying to figure out how to do it. And it became, you know, it was like, okay, that what better place than a small town in Kansas, the center of the United States, to let people understand that it doesn't matter where you're from or who you are, but, you know, you have a purpose in life and you can affect everybody around you in different ways. And so they talk oftentimes about this, you know, group of Protestant students from a small Kansas town who discovered the story. I mean, a woman, a Catholic woman in Poland who saved Jewish children. So, you know, it was just like tying all of us together.
It's an incredible story. Where can people go to find out more about Mommy, Who is Irina Sendler, the book, and about the work? Where do they go to find out more?
Okay, the website is lowellmilkencenter.org.
That's L-O-W-E-L-L, Milken, M-I-L-K-E-N, center.org, right?
Correct, correct. There's one other website, too, that this, the lowellmilkencenter.org, tells the whole story of the center and has Irina's story and all the other unsung heroes. There is a site dedicated to Irina Sendler's story and the whole Life in a Jar project, and that one is irinasendler.org.
It's a remarkable story in the Life in a Jar story. First of all, it's a great name, but also, you know, a tribute to the incredible work she did. Kathy, thank you for a wonderful visit here on Too Jewish.
Well, thank you for having me, and I love sharing the story, so it's been a win-win situation.
Best of luck with the book. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Mark Gittler of 929 North America, the online and app-based daily Bible chapter study program. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from Eitan Katz. For the month of Adar, we are in the midst of, one of the two Adars. The song is Mishenichnas Adar. When we enter Adar, we multiply joy. My friends, may your joy be multiplied this week, and may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Mishenichnas Adar, marbi, marbi, marbi misimcha. 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 Mishenichnas Adar, marbi. Mi shenichnas, ah.
sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.